anatomy, this is the third of my themes, again beginning in Glasgow. Glasgow, the great museum in Glasgow, the University Museum, founded in 1807, therefore very early, not early by Ashmolean standards, but early by everybody else's standards, by William Hunter, the Queen's gynecologist, the obstetrician, the Queen's great teacher of anatomy and great collector. His own work, the human gravid uterus, an example on the left, life size. These are not books for students to carry around in the normal course of their affairs, but involving a lot of number of leading artists. And Hunter was professor of anatomy at the Royal Academy, and there indeed in the Zoffany picture is he lecturing away, demonstrating on a figure with his top off, and with a figure we know from John Hunter's account is a criminal cart from Tyburn who was flayed, cast himself in rigor mortis, and then was cast in plaster as an anatomical demonstration piece. Joshua Reynolds is there, visible, listening with his ear trumpet, and the academicians are all grouped around. It's not a teaching session, literally. It's a history picture of the academicians acknowledging their professor of anatomy. He collected masses of anatomical drawings as well, and amongst them, Helen Brock, the professor of history, said there's some interesting anatomical drawings here by somebody called Berrettini. And had been overlooked, and there's a complete set of Pietro da Cortona's anatomical drawings for the publication which he illustrated. Very spectacular, and the letter was there in the Hunterian recording that William Hamilton had given this to Hunter, thinking it was appropriate for him. So these things sort of dropped into one's lap, and Helen Brock also pointed out that the Hunter Royal Academy lectures were there in manuscript form, in some chaos, written on backs of envelopes, on miscellaneous sheets of paper. So I got an absolutely flying start, A1 unpublished material, which, I would rather hate to say this with doctoral students in the department, sort of dropped into my lap without my looking for them, which is a matter of extraordinary good fortune. But it got me interested in these big anatomical picture books, always talked about in the history of anatomy, but is this really history of anatomy at all? It's certainly not Henry Gray's Anatomy Descriptive and Surgical. It just doesn't fit with our modern conception of anatomy as a descriptive science. There are all sorts of rhetorics going on here, neo-Stoic rhetorics, if you read the text, particularly of on the left is Vesalius, but if you read Charles Etienne's text on the right, it's full of neo-Stoic philosophy about the grandeur of the human being in the drama of nature, as it were. So that is what is going on there. There are obviously gender things going on, but complicated, because it's all very well for the feminists to say the woman is shown in this violated way. On the whole, the men are not less violated, so the gender choices actually are rather more subtle, of showing the women in bedrooms and the men in landscapes. So there are lots of complicated issues here, which on the whole are grists of the mill of the art historian, but were at that time relatively new in the history of science. So it's obviously enormously changed subsequently. That led through to the exhibition work which Marina and I have been doing, in particular, Spectacular Bodies at the Hayward Gallery in 19... I'm very bad on dates, 89? 2000, yeah, it's the Leonardo show in 1989. I know all Leonardo's dates, but mine are completely elusive, which looked at this great tradition through to the 20th century of anatomy and art. I've chosen this installation slide because there's one of the Hunter écorchés, there's the normal style of it. This, the Smuglerius, is a cast made by Hunter of a criminal in the form of the dying gladiator. We had the Rembrandt Anatomy of Dr. Diamond. I can't pronounce Dutch names, so Christopher, I'm sorry about that. And contemporary artists, this great wax, looking like a historic wax, is by John Isaacs, And what we like to do is to involve contemporary artists, not just dropping works in, but get them involved over the 4 or 5 year planning stage. And this is a self-portrait by John Isaacs in gory anatomical detail, a work of great potency, but we like to work conspiratorially with the contemporary artists rather than just drop them in as kind of accidental visitors, as it were. And leading on more recently, and I'm going to say a little about it because it's still fresh, at least in my memory, Seduced, the Art and Sex exhibition at the Barbican, which was a natural follow-up. As if you ask what the bodies do, they spend a lot of time eating. We did think about a food exhibition at one point and having sex, so this is the choice was fairly obvious in this case. The loans we got were very, very extraordinary. The satyr and the nymph from the Capitoline Museum, behind that the hermaphrodite from the Borghese. You can see down here the Lavinia Fontana, a picture by a woman of Minerva, also from the Borghese, and so on. It juxtaposed upstairs the 20th century artists, but you could see them. This is Andy Warhol's blowjob at the balcony at the upper level. And here, Jeff Koons, when you're on the balcony, you can see with La Cicciolina. And here, a whole series of Greek pots, which are Etruscan pots, which are no less explicit than the Jeff Koons. So there were these juxtapositions, which I hope weren't too blatant, but were very telling. The model is there. To say that we always work with designers integrally from the beginning, namely Paul Williams of Stanton Williams, who we've worked with and I've worked with going back to the Leonardo show in 1989. And this is one of Paul's early models, and it just shows you the extent to which, you know, we're even beginning to hang objects. In fact, these great service ducts became the ends of rooms, so we actually turned the secretum in the British Museum, Gabinetto Segreto from Naples, and the secretum from the British Museum were secreted in these rooms. So this is a relatively early model, but it does show the extent to which the exhibition in our book is never planned as a concept. It's always designer, place, book designer. The whole thing is actually an experience involving all these skills at each point. Upstairs in the human Spectacular Bodies show, we had heads, physiognomics. Lombroso, in particular. These are both Lombroso. This is the skull of Vihela, the criminal, which he examined and believed he had found a cranial anatomical feature, which explained why Vihela, who was a kind of Italian Jack the Ripper, why he behaved as he did. And this instituted a whole school of Lombrosian criminal psychology, which basically identified visual traits, signs, including outward signs like tattoos, shapes of noses, prostitutes' feet, and things of this sort. So this sort of pseudo-science of identification. And above is one of his photographic groups from Turin, of a family of criminals, and you're meant to be able to understand something from that. That more recently, and again I'll only touch on this, leads through to The Human Animal, the book I published as a set of, well, began as a set of lectures in Chicago, published fairly recently, looking at this interplay between humans and animals in the visual arts, also in linguistics and philosophy, and it got slightly broader with circuses and feral children and automata and heaven knows what. But this is one I particularly like and had written about earlier in Nature. This is Spencer Tracy turning from Dr. Jekyll into Mr. Hyde, and I've juxtaposed it there with an illustration by Wolf for the Darwin Expressions in Animal and Man. This is a Niger macaque being aroused, and of course this is exactly right, because Spencer Tracy in his form feels this demonic arousal, the releasing of the animal within, which is the precise term used by Robert Louis Stevenson, and this got me through into films and Dracula and all sorts of unexpected not unexpected, but in interesting areas. And this, of course, has enormous contemporary resonances. You can hardly go into any paper or any news program on the radio about some atrocity without them saying they're beasts, animals. The gang that was recently convicted for kicking a young woman to death, the judge said they behaved like feral beasts. The Austrian one this morning, I was listening to the news story, and somebody said that man who imprisoned those children is a beast. What beast does that? No beast would do that. It's not good evolutionary practice to have children with your own daughter. So this is profoundly human, yet we feel obliged to transfer the blame, as it were, to the beast within us, when in fact in this case it's absolutely not. This Times one is interesting, as the story begins. This is Abdul Razak, who is a suicide bomber. You can't read it here, but he said there is no trace of evil in the beaming face of Abdul Razak. As if you're meant to see somehow that this man is a beast. Inside, Ariel Sharon said, this man is an animal. One of the things I'm interested in is these long traditions, and I'll come back to that at the end, which are still with us, and often inadvertently we're part of the tradition without ever stepping back and realizing that we are, and often how dreadfully pernicious these traditional stances can be. Optics, and I'll move on fairly quickly through this. I got into this by teaching. I had to teach in Glasgow perspective in the first year, and reading the accounts of the Brunelleschi invention of perspective seemed to be a nightmare of non-method. It really set my teeth on edge, so I got going via having to teach it, which is, again, it's an interesting interplay that I came into the profession to teach and to research, and these are utterly complementary. All the other stuff we do is a different matter. Oh, I was interested in other optical qualities as well, not just perspective and colour, which I wrote about in The Science of Art, but this one I particularly like, the Pura della Francesca Senegalia Madonna. I got very puzzled by the light coming in the window here. And if you go and look at it in the original, and it's now sadly no longer in Senegalia, it's in Urbino, this beam is characterised by 1,000 little impasted spots of light, little atomi. This is what Leonardo calls them, it's what Dante calls them, dust in the air. These atomi, they come ultimately from Epicurus or from Lucretius, from classical atomic theory. And Dante sees a vision of a cross in this form, a little atomi jumping in the air. Anyway, here are the atomi jumping in the air. But oddly, there was a disjunction between the beam, as you could see, and the top of it on the wall. And I thought, what's going on here? So, and this is part of the modelling, which if I ever get this far in this lecture, I got a box in the basement of the house in St Andrews, where I then was, much to my wife's alarm, filled it with smoke from burning paper, and looked to see what happened. And as you can see, when you look at the beam from a non-perpendicular angle, the top of the big beam becomes almost transparent and invisible, and you get that kink. That's astonishing. You know, Piero must have looked fantastically hard. We know he's a slow painter. You know, enormous amount of effort went into it. But like Leonardo, he looked at things with a kind of, like, with this childish intensity, but with the intellectual apparatus of a genius to back it up. It's a very, very extraordinary thing to do. And these things I find enormously exciting, which you suddenly think, wow, and this is just amazing. And it's the sort of thing that gives me and gave me a continual buzz. Other modelling and other optical qualities. We were asked actually to look at, or I was asked to look at this particular painting, which is one of a series of works by Caravaggio. This was previously in Badminton, now owned in America, and to look at the optical qualities of it. And this carafe, brilliantly painted with a window down this side and a very complex series of reflections and refractions, we thought, well, let's try to model that, because it migrates from painting to painting. The boy bitten by a lizard and here, and the you can't rationalize in the boy bitten by the lizard in particular this light pattern, because it doesn't belong in that painting. No, literally it doesn't belong. We know that Caravaggio had painted for Cardinal Del Monte a carafe of flowers, and clearly other patrons said, I want one of those, so he stuffed them in and out of various paintings. Again, this technical thing is actually about social history of art as well. They're not separate considerations. Anyway, here we are. This was the first cardboard model. This is Teresa Crow, now Wells, of the Universal Leonardo, but here working on this is Gilbert McCarricker, who's a graphic designer and a former student of Marina's. We exploit our former students remorselessly. Teresa was a former doctoral student of mine. And we came up with a horizontal light source here and a high light source to get this precise effect in a glass carafe. There are obviously lots of variables, which I can't go into here, but it did show an astonishing level of, again, of scrutiny of the actual phenomenon. Now, the context for this, to some extent, was the work I've been doing with David Hockney about Caravaggio and about optical instruments. David went to the Ang exhibition in Paris, became convinced that Ang used a camera lucida, that lens, that prism-based device he's using there. David did a whole series of portraits, including various people who washed up in his studio at one point or another, and developed this theory about optical imitation being the dominant trend in Western art from the Renaissance up until the birth of photography. It's expressed in this diagram. Optical imitation goes on in this way. This is the heyday of film. And the eyeballers, the people who draw freehand, including Michelangelo, he'd be very relieved about that, Rembrandt and so on, divert from that line. I would have that as a single solid thick line. I wouldn't differentiate it. But what happens here is terrifically interesting, because here you've got Impressionism, Cézanne, Picasso, etc., etc., diverging. They eventually merge in a postmodern chaos. But it's very interesting if you think about where does this mainstream of Western art go? Where does this thick band of naturalism go? It goes into popular art, it goes into photography, it goes into film, it goes into all those arts which are basically photographically inclined. And that then makes fine art, in the modern sense, look like a highly specialized, rather experimental field, mirroring the other professions. And so you can begin to plot some pretty nice big things, which out of the David Hockney hypothesis. And I'm not much interested in these minute arguments. Did artist X use the device, or artist Y not? I'm interested in the bigger picture, the bigger splash, as it were, that David is interested in. The reaction of most art historians has been profoundly territorial and profoundly uncreative. Then other sciences. This has found its most immediate expression in the column I've been writing in for Nature since 1997. This is the sort of thing I was interested in, looking at initially and entirely without brief at relationships. On the left, one of these microscopic shelled sea creatures, a Nassalarian, Calimatra agnese, that particular one. And Darcy Thompson's comparison, which is very Leonardesque, Darcy Thompson, Growth and Form, 1917, one of the books which every architect who's interested in natural engineering, every engineer looks at, and still does. Cecil Baumann, Norman Foster, Richard Rogers, you say Darcy Thompson, they all, and here is Darcy Thompson comparing the Nassalarian skeleton with a tetrahedral cage of wire with a soap bubble in it, which was explored by Plateau, the great Belgian physicist. And the artistic consequence of this is not really the artistic consequence, but one of the artistic variations upon these kinds of ideas by Naam Garbo in these remarkable strung sculptures. So I was doing these little 600 worders once a week in Nature. I now do them once a month, once a week. Didn't run out of ideas, but obviously the pressure of deadlines became, on the whole, rather frantic. And out of that, this working across all these sciences, I developed the concept, which I've not been pushing too hard, but which I think a useful shorthand, I can't take my jacket off, I lose the sound, of structural intuitions. And I can best illustrate that. What I mean by structural intuitions is the inherent structure-making aspects of nature, self-organization, as it would be called, and the conceptual apparatus we've been endowed with to pick up upon that orderliness of nature. It's a kind of conspiracy between our perceptual apparatus and the organizing properties of nature. And it's best through this example with an artist who Marina and I know fairly well, Jonathan Callan. And one of the works he did consisted of sieving cement powder through a plate in which he had drilled holes at irregular, though not totally random, intervals. And of course the cement dust drops through and you end up with this miraculous landscape, this amazing mountainous landscape, looking a bit like a Leonardo in an odd kind of way. I said to Jonathan, do you know about pare back and self-organized criticality? He said, no, there's no reason he should do. This is the theory of the sand pile, which has been applied to traffic jams and all sorts of phenomena, and has had a very wide-ranging aspect of it. Anybody who wants to know about it, pare back wrote a very accessible book, B-A-K, not B-A-C-K. I published this and aligned it with self-organized criticality and explained how the geometry of the structure came about. And Adrian Webster in astronomy wrote it and said, these are Voronoi cells. If you take a series of points and you work out to which one a given particle will go, say the points are vacuums, then the division which determines whether they go to one or the other is a cellular division, and that's the final version of the Voronoi tessellation. And that one of the notions for the organizations of the galaxies at the moment is that if you take a Voronoi foam, a 3D version of this, they're aligned along the walls of the Voronoi foam. I'm not much bothered whether this is right or wrong, but I'm enormously interested in the mode of conception and perception. The artist is working with the materials and getting there by a kind of instinct, by an intuition. The scientists begin with much the same kind of thing, but they obviously express it in a quite different kind of way. And the kind of continuities I'm interested in, Leonardo on the left, the truncated dodecahedron, one of the very brilliant versions of skeletal bodies that he designed for Luca Pacioli, the man who wrote the treatise on chess. The Kepler model, and it was to be built, meant to be built as a model, and clock animated with clockwork of the planetary system, envisaged as a series of Platonic solids nested or inscribed in spheres and then progressively nested in that way. A remarkable vision which he abandoned when he advocated elliptical orbits, but nonetheless an extraordinary act of visualization. And recently, Jean-Pierre Lumineux and astronomers in Paris have been advocating a model of the universe, which is finite, not infinite, on a curved octahedron in multi-dimensions, which means you can enter one face and exit the same face at the same time, envisaged on the right there. But again, without going into the technicalities of it, I'm interested in these continuities of acts of modelling and visualisation, how even the modern astronomers seeking the deepest secrets of what we know is a universe of incredibly complex space-time actually deal with these things. And on the smallest scale, Harry Croteau, who and the Buckyball team, Carbon 60, Harry Croteau, who in the Buckyball five-a-side football team is kneeling there with the blue shirt on, from Sussex, then working in Atlanta. He himself had wished to become a designer at an early time of his life before becoming a scientist, and he'd been in Expo 67 and seen the Buckminster Fuller American Pavilion on the island in the middle of the St. Lawrence, which survives as a skeleton having been burnt by fire. And in getting this carbon 60 array, carbon normally is in flat sheets. His experience of that, his interest in Buckminster Fuller, and his natural design abilities, the fact he can visualize in a designer's way, meant that he was the one in the team who worked specifically on the three-dimensional structure, along with all the experimental data. And also indulging in process as well. Darcy Thompson, once again, looking at the photographs of Worthington, who was the first person to take stroboscopic photographs of spheres dropped into milk, which is a fairly viscous fluid and allows you to get the patterns pretty well. And this is the later Edgerton Strobe Alley version from MIT, well known as a violently coloured red poster. And Thompson comparing it with these medusoids, with these sea creatures. This is viscous fluids dropping down, less viscous fluids. And it became a sort of popular image. These milk mark lorries were trundling around the lanes in Oxfordshire at one point. I asked the man in the depot if people really recognised this, and he said, I don't think they really do. Anyway, it was a branding exercise which lasted about 4 years and has now moved on, as all branding exercises do, but I think it probably wasn't enormously successful. But who should have the 1945 edition of Darcy Thompson but Jackson Pollock, the great dripper and splasher? I don't wish to go into the implications of that, but you can begin to imagine it for yourselves. I will cut the lecture short, just give me five more minutes, and I've got this is I'm normally very good on timing, but perhaps this does mean I should be retiring. Yeah. Just one other bit of modelling. This is the Leonardo show in the Victoria and Albert Museum from a year or so ago, coming back to the heart again, with these brilliant computer graphics by Steve Maher along the upper region, and the Leonardo drawings along the lower region. Very risky. But in fact, it was set up by Paul Williams in this wonderful way that you could look at the drawings and not be aware of the animations at all. But when you step back, you could get a sense of a visual commentary on the drawings that you were about to look at or had looked at. And one of the things we leapt off from here is that this sheet of the drawings of the vortices in the heart says, make a model in glass and put membranes in it. When I was in California at the Getty, I met Maury Garib, who is professor of aeronautical and biological engineering, which is an extraordinary Leonardesque thing to be. And he was already interested in modelling this, so we worked on a model of it. This is looking down on Maury's valve with the three cups here, the three cusps, which you saw twitching in the earlier animation. And he used modern imaging techniques to look at what was happening inside the valve. You think, wow. No, Leonardo couldn't have seen this. I'm not really interested whether Leonardo is right or wrong, but I'm interested in the insight into how to get there. And this is just awesome, isn't it? That the valves work entirely by the filling of by these vortices, which are caused by the constricted neck of the aorta. And let me just move on. Yep, and the other acts of modelling. The flying machines, the one we did in 1989, the one we did now, and to make a point that a model depends upon what end it has in view. The model here of the Hayward Gallery exhibition does actually move and flap in an amazingly sinuous way, but that was the brief we gave James Wink, the model designer, to make the Ornithopter as a Uccello, as a flapping machine. The brief for the television program we did was quite different, and that was to see how much lift we could get from a Leonardo wing. And the designers, the historic plane restorers who built this for us got very interested in this drawing, which I'd barely looked at, and they said, this is very promising. They said, what's that? And I said, that's panel, that means cloth. And the cloth is wrapped over there and comes back here. And they said, ah, we got a leading edge. And this is the one that actually flew. And I'll leave you with this. The beginning of this sequence is, this is very early Hayward Gallery computer graphics, which I haven't been able to tease out. And I'll just let this run, but it gets onto the flying machine at the end of the day. Anyway, this will be the last thing I'll do, so we can watch this. I'll explain a bit what's going on. This was done by the IBM Research Center at Winchester using ray tracing, exactly the technique Leonardo used for judging the intensity of light on the head by dint of its angular impact. This is looking at sheen. There are three sorts of light in the Renaissance. There's light from the source, light on the object, and shine. This is looking at questions of occlusion. The IBM Research Center at Winchester thought that this would be fairly simple to do all these Leonardo things, but it took six of their people in the research center 6 months doing a whole series of computer graphics. We did centralized churches, branching systems, Last Supper perspective, etc., etc. This is 1989, which is kind of early. Leonardo was obsessed with differences of size of light, size of object, distance of plane on which the shadow fell. And insisted that if you were to remake nature, then you needed to understand all these laws. They may seem obvious to us, but these are the demands he made upon veridical recreation of nature, not imitation of it.
Late autumn on the Eastbourne coast, and a perfect day for all creatures to take to the air. It's finally the moment, nearly 3 months in the making, for the maiden flight of Leonardo's glider. The atmosphere is charged here on High Over Hill. As the builders, their families, pilot Judy and her husband head down to the launch site, it feels like history in the making. And that's precisely why Leonardo expert Martin Kemp is here too.
I think it's just absolutely amazingly beautiful. Whether it flies or not, it's a beautiful thing.
Whether it flies or not now depends on Judy's skills and nerve.
It's just all so unknown. I just have to think clearly about everything that I do and not get overruled by me.
It took over an hour before Judy got a feel for the wing. She started to bring Leonardo's dream machine to life.
It's a bit of a gust. It's a bit of a gust and it just dropped. Yeah. That was lovely.
Yeah.
Actually, we managed to keep it online.
Yeah.
So it's going up a couple of times. Yeah. Tiny bit of control.
Yeah. A little
just
bit of roll, isn't there?
So subtle. Just such a tiny bit. The pitch is huge.
With this flight, Judy matched the Wright brothers' record-setting attempt in 1903. She's flown 60 yards down the hillside above head height. 500 years on, Leonardo's dream of flight is coming true, and the mood is jubilant.